Usually when we look at a catastrophic failure, whether it's a suspension bridge collapsing into a river, or a massive corporation suddenly filing for bankruptcy, or honestly, a highly respected leader stepping down in disgrace, there's this deeply ingrained human expectation of a singular, highly visible event.
Oh, absolutely. We want a clear cause.
Right, exactly. We look for an earthquake or a sudden market crash, a lightning strike. We desperately want to find this external force that caused the destruction so we can point at it and say, there, that is the villain. That unpredictable anomaly is what brought the whole thing down.
Well, I mean, it is incredibly comforting to blame the elements, isn't it? We prefer the narrative to be about a strong structure that was simply, overwhelmed by an unpredictable storm.
Yeah, it takes the blame off us.
Exactly. It absolves us of having to look at the foundation itself. Because if the foundation was the problem, it means the collapse was happening silently over a long period of time, right in front of everyone.
Right. But then you step into the world of human leadership, of spirituality, of profound giftedness, and suddenly that comforting narrative completely falls apart.
It really does. It shatters.
I mean, we're looking at a modern landscape today that is honestly littered with the wreckage of highly gifted, incredibly successful individuals who absolutely did not fall to an external storm.
No, they didn't.
They collapsed from the inside out. They fell because their internal architecture failed. And the text we're diving into today diagnoses exactly why that happens.
It's a heavy text.
It really is. I want to tell you, the listener, right up front, this is not our usual upbeat, purely curious exploration. Today's deep dive is profoundly reflective. It's instructive. And to be completely blunt, it is urgent.
It is deeply urgent. And what makes the document we're analyzing today so compelling is that it doesn't give us a convenient list of external threats to watch out for, you
Right,
know?
no checklist of bad PR moves.
Exactly. It doesn't point to cultural shifts or like external pressures. It acts as a mirror. It forces us to look entirely at the internal engineering of the human soul. It provides a literal framework for understanding the mechanics of a moral collapse.
Exactly. So our source today is this singular, incredibly powerful theological allegory called The Treasure and the Table. And our mission for this deep dive is to explore the stark, practical human warning embedded in this story.
It's basically a blueprint, right?
Yes, a blueprint for understanding why highly gifted individuals, people with massive influence, undeniable talent, and real spiritual calling, so often experience these catastrophic moral or spiritual failures.
And while the text uses spiritual and theological language, the diagnostic tool it provides applies to every single person listening to this right now.
Oh, absolutely.
If you possess ambition, talent, or a desire for greater responsibility, this is for you. The principles it outlines regarding power, character, and structural integrity are completely universal.
Let's just start by walking into the allegorical room where this entire story begins. Because you have to understand why a collapse happens. We first have to understand the construction.
Right, set the scene.
So the text asks us to imagine a beautifully designed, pristine room. And right in the center of this space stands a wooden table. It's newly constructed. Into this room walks a master craftsman.
And this is where it gets interesting.
Yeah, he approaches the table and he begins to place magnificent, radiant treasure upon it. The text describes this treasure as priceless, glowing with a divine brilliance.
But then it throws in that twist.
Exactly. It immediately introduces a critical physical characteristic that changes everything. The treasure is immensely, almost unfathomably heavy.
And that physical detail, the weight, is the linchpin of the entire allegory. The text isn't just painting a pretty picture here, it's establishing a system of physics.
Right, the rules of this universe.
Exactly. The framework establishes that the treasure represents spiritual power. It represents supernatural gifts, divine calling, influence, and what the text refers to as an anointing operating through a person.
Let's define that word anointing, just so we're all on the same page. In the context of this document, it essentially means a sudden influx of unearned capacity, right?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
It's a divine mandate or a supernatural enablement to do something way beyond normal human ability. It's the power to lead, to heal, to speak with profound authority.
Exactly. The text treats this power as an objective substance. And the table, the wooden structure holding up this glowing substance, represents the human being's character.
The character is the table. That is such a vivid image.
It is. It's their moral foundation, their internal integrity, their psychological maturity. And the text takes it a step further by defining the actual building materials of this table.
What kind of wood are we talking about here?
it argues that the legs, the crossbeams, and the supports are built out of what theological traditions call the fruits of the Spirit. But it treats these not just as nice moral qualities, but as actual structural engineering concepts.
Wait, I love that. Give me an example.
So for a table to withstand the weight placed upon it, it has to be reinforced with the tensile strength of honesty. It needs the load-bearing capacity of humility, the resilience of patience, and the binding force of sacrificial love.
Here's where I have to pause, because this framework completely upends our normal assumptions about talent and power.
Oh, completely.
We usually think of treasure as something light, right? We think of a gift as a joy, a blessing, something meant to be spent or enjoyed.
Like finding a winning lottery ticket.
Exactly. When we think of a person receiving immense talent or a divine calling, we think of it as giving them wings. We assume power elevates a person. But here, the defining physical characteristic of the treasure is its crushing weight.
It's a burden.
Why is spiritual power treated as a physical burden that requires structural engineering to even hold?
It's a profound shift in perspective, really. The text forces us to look at the reality of how power operates. Power, by its very nature, exerts massive force.
It pushes down.
Yes. When an individual receives spiritual power, influence, or a heavy calling, they are receiving an influx of energy that is not native to the fragile human frame.
I mean, we are fragile.
Incredibly so. The human ego is notoriously brittle. It is prone to self-deception, insecurity, vanity. If you place the massive, undeniable gravity of divine power onto a brittle human ego, the ego just cannot bear it.
It warps.
It warps under the pressure. The text is arguing that power is not buoyant, it is dense.
You know, it's like dropping a massive, heavy-duty commercial freight train engine into the chassis of a lightweight sports car.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Right. The engine itself is brilliant. It's powerful, perfectly tuned, capable of pulling thousands of tons. But the frame of the sports car wasn't built for that kind of torque.
Not at all.
The moment you turn the key and that engine roars to life, the sheer rotational force is going to twist the car's frame, shear the bolts, and literally vibrate the entire vehicle to pieces.
That analogy perfectly captures the mechanics the text is describing. The engine will destroy the car, not because the engine is bad, but because the chassis is completely inadequate.
Right.
The text is telling us that without the dense reinforcement of humility and sacrificial love, the human frame simply isn't designed to bear the weight of divine brilliance.
It needs that reinforcement.
Exactly. Humility in this allegory isn't just about being, you know, self-effacing or quiet. It is literally the only psychological material dense enough to absorb the gravity of power without warping.
That is fascinating. Honesty is the joinery.
Yes. Honesty is the only joinery tight enough to keep the structural integrity intact when the pressure of public scrutiny or massive responsibility bears down.
So if the table is built out of cheap, porous materials, like a desire for fame, a need for external validation, or raw ego, what happens?
The moment the heavy treasure is placed on it, those materials will instantly splinter.
Which, honestly, immediately casts a very harsh light on how we operate today.
It really does.
If you accept this premise, that power is inherently heavy and character must be structurally sound to survive it, then the modern landscape of leadership and influence looks like a slow-motion disaster.
It looks completely irrational, is what it looks like. The text outlines this profound modern malady, diagnosing a fundamental sickness in how individuals and institutions approach the concept of giftedness.
We are getting it all wrong.
Completely. It points out that everywhere you look, people are aggressively pursuing the treasure. They're praying for more power, seeking higher platforms, demanding more influence, and begging the craftsmen to stack more gold onto their lives.
Just pile it on.
Right. And yet, while they are obsessively hunting for more weight, they are entirely neglecting the structural integrity of their table.
So they're basically asking for a ton of solid gold to be dropped onto a cheap folding card table with wobbly, unglued legs. And somehow, they think the gold will fix the wobble.
That's the delusion. They assume the presence of the power will magically generate the character required to sustain it. But the text argues the exact opposite.
But I want to play devil's advocate here for a second, because isn't ambition supposed to be a good thing?
Sure, in some contexts.
I mean, if the treasure represents a divine calling, an ability to heal, to lead people to truth, or to change the world for the better, shouldn't people want as much of it as possible?
You think so?
If you want to make a massive impact, you need the massive treasure to do it. Why is the pursuit of this power framed as so dangerous?
Well, the text provides a brilliant analogy to answer exactly that question. To explain why this specific type of ambition is fatal, it asks us to imagine a bank vault.
Okay, a bank vault. I'm picturing it.
Imagine a bank employee whose assigned duty is to work inside that vault. Their job is to organize the ledgers, sweep the floors, secure the assets, and generally maintain the facility.
Just standard operational stuff.
Right. But instead of doing the unglamorous work of maintaining the vault, this employee spends their entire day obsessively staring at the massive stacks of cash.
Oh, wow.
They are utterly fascinated by the wealth. They want to hold it. They want to stand near it. They're entirely consumed by the sheer volume of the treasure surrounding them.
I mean, even if they aren't stuffing it into their pockets, that behavior immediately sets off alarm bells.
Precisely. Ask yourself, what does bank management do when they see that on the security cameras?
They fire them.
They immediately recognize that this employee cannot be trusted. The employee's obsession with the wealth, rather than their dedication to the duty of their job, completely disqualifies them.
That makes perfect sense.
The text uses this to deliver a piercing insight. Ambition for the wealth, meaning the power, the gifts, the platform, that outpaces a person's commitment to their character, makes them fundamentally untrustworthy.
That is, wow, that is fascinating. Wanting the power more than you want the character required to wield it properly is essentially a giant red flag to the creator.
A massive red flag.
It signals that you're captivated by the glory of the gift rather than the heavy responsibility of holding it.
And the text drives this home with a very sobering theological claim. It says, God is not looking for more treasure.
Right, because according to the framework, he is the source of it. He isn't experiencing a shortage of power or brilliance.
Exactly. He has all the treasure he needs. What he is experiencing is a severe shortage of tables.
A shortage of tables. Wow.
He is actively searching for individuals who are not begging for power, but who are focused entirely on building a strong, humble character. Those are the candidates he is looking for.
So if you're the employee in the vault, quietly doing the unglamorous work of tightening the screws on your integrity.
Yes, sweeping the floors of your own ego, making sure your honesty is completely uncompromising, management notices that.
They see who is actually working.
The text argues that those are the only people who can be trusted with heavy spiritual power precisely because they do not covet it. They are simply prepared to hold it.
But we all know that unprepared people manage to get their hands on power all the time.
Unfortunately, yes.
Sometimes they're naturally charismatic. Sometimes they manipulate their way into a platform. Sometimes they receive a genuine, undeniable gift from the craftsman early on, but then they completely stop working on their character.
They just abandon the table.
Right. So if the treasure is heavy and the table is weak, we have to talk about what happens next. We have to talk about structural strain.
This brings us to the anatomy of a failure. And this section of the text requires incredibly careful attention because it maps out the psychology of a downfall with chilling accuracy.
It's like a step-by-step guide to disaster.
Exactly. It explains exactly how a moral collapse happens step by step.
It starts with what the text calls the slow buckle. It makes the point that tables rarely shatter without warning.
Almost never.
A collapse isn't a singular out-of-the-blue event like a lightning strike. When the weight of the power, the platform, the ministry, or the influence exceeds the strength of a person's character, the table begins a slow, agonizing deformation.
It is the literal laws of physics applied to the human psyche. Pressure always seeks out the weakest point.
Always.
If you have a massive platform, but your structural leg of humility has a tiny hairline fracture of vanity in it, the immense weight of the treasure will relentlessly press down on that specific fracture until it begins to widen.
The text gives us a very specific haunting phrase for this. It calls these warning signs the audible splinters of a straining table.
Audible splinters. It's such a visceral image.
It really is. What do those splinters actually look like in human behavior, though? The text identifies them as small compromises in honesty, sudden flares of pride, and uncharacteristic moments of impatience or anger.
And we really need to pause here and recognize how terrifyingly ordinary those cracks sound.
That is the most unsettling part, a flare of impatience, a small exaggeration. In our modern culture, we usually excuse those behaviors entirely, especially in successful people.
Oh, we justify them all the time.
We say, oh, he's just under a lot of pressure, or she's just incredibly driven. She has a huge vision, so of course she's demanding. We don't look at a leader losing their temper with an assistant and say, ah, listen to that. an audible splinter of a straining table.
We don't, but the text insists that we absolutely must. It strips away all of our modern psychological excuses for bad behavior.
Doesn't let anyone off the hook.
Right. We treat a flare of pride or an ego trip as a quirky personality trait of a genius. The text treats it as an acoustic warning of an impending structural collapse.
Let's unpack the psychology here because it's so relevant. When a highly gifted leader starts bending the truth slightly, maybe fudging the numbers to make their organization look more successful, we often call that a marketing strategy.
Yeah, we rebrand it.
But the text argues that this is the wood of their honesty, physically splintering under the crushing weight of their ambition.
Exactly. And when a leader becomes suddenly impatient with accountability, refusing to let anyone question their decisions because of their supposed anointing or expertise, that is the structural crossbeam of humility violently snapping.
You can almost hear the wood groaning. You can hear the internal fibers tearing apart. But the tragedy is that because the treasure sitting on top of the table is still glowing, because the organization is still making money, the platform is still growing, and the power is still outwardly manifesting, everyone in the room completely ignores the sound of the cracking wood.
Including, most tragically, the leader themselves.
Oh.
They suffer from a profound self-deception. They look at the undeniable results of their gifts and think, well, the treasure is still here, it's still heavy, so God must still be pleased with me, I must be fine.
The results speak for themselves.
Exactly. Yeah. But the text introduces a consequence to this slow buckle that is absolutely devastating. As the structure warps, the text introduces the concept of the defiled ground.
Let's visualize this. The table is tilting, the legs are bowing outward under the immense weight. And as the surface of the table ceases to be level, the text says that pieces of this heavy divine treasure begin to slide off the edges.
They just slip right off.
They fall and they hit the floor. And the text describes the floor beneath the table as dirty, muddy, and defiled. In this framework, the ground represents human carnality.
Let's define carnality so it doesn't just sound like an abstract religious buzzword. In this context, carnality represents the unrefined, base, selfish impulses of human nature.
The dark stuff.
It is raw ego, greed, the desire to dominate others, and self-preservation at all costs. It is the psychological dirt that character is supposed to elevate us above.
And here is the core tragedy of the entire allegory. The text argues that the moment holy spiritual power slides off the table and touches the defiled ground of human carnality, the treasure itself becomes corrupted.
The pure gift is tainted by the dirt it lands in.
If we look at how gifts operate in the real world, this explains so much of the toxic behavior we see in fallen leaders. Think about the gift of administration or organization.
It's a vital gift.
It is a brilliant, necessary gift. But when a leader's character buckles, that gift slides off the table into the mud of carnality and it immediately turns into the machinery of corporate tyranny and micromanagement.
It becomes oppressive. Or think about the gift of prophetic insight or deep empathy and understanding of people.
Oh, that's a dangerous one to drop in the mud.
It is. When that falls into the mud of ego, it weaponizes into a tool for spiritual manipulation and emotional control. The gift of profound communication and rhetoric falls into the mud and becomes sheer demagoguery and narcissistic self-promotion.
The power itself is still real. The rhetorical skill is real. The organizational genius is real. But it is now completely coated in the defilement of the leader's broken character. It's muddy treasure.
Exactly. It's muddy treasure. But the text does something very surprising here. It does not present the initial cracking of the wood as a punishment from the creator.
Wait, it doesn't.
No, it frames the audible splinters as a profound mercy.
That reframes everything. So the warning signs aren't the craftsmen trying to destroy you. They are the structure trying to save you.
Yes. These early structural failures, the sudden flare of irrational anger, the small lie you got caught in, the creeping urge to hide your financial actions from your board, these are merciful, blaring alarms.
They are the check engine light flashing on the dashboard of your soul.
And what are you supposed to do when the check engine light flashes? You don't hit the gas. You pull over.
Right. You stop the car.
The splinters are designed to provoke a sudden halt. When you hear the wood of your own character splinter, the text insists that you must initiate immediate, deep repentance. You have to take the weight off the table.
So you step down.
You step down from the platform, you voluntarily reduce your exposure, you hand over your responsibilities, and you get out the tools to reinforce your character before a total collapse occurs. The craftsman allows the table to groan loudly so that you have time to brace it.
It's a window of grace. But the brutal reality of human history and the core tension of this text is that warnings are only useful if they are actually heeded.
And they so rarely are.
What happens when the pride, the sheer momentum, or the blind ambition of the individual causes them to ignore the splinters? What happens when a leader just slaps a fresh coat of PR paint over the massive crack in their honesty, demands even more treasure from the craftsman, and insists on keeping the show going?
Then the window of grace closes. We move from the anatomy of a failure into the reality of absolute catastrophe.
The text is very clear on the physics of what happens next. If a person demands to continue operating in power without doing the agonizing work of fixing their character, the table inevitably suffers a catastrophic final collapse.
It shatters completely.
The legs give out entirely. The structure is destroyed. The individual falls. But here is the detail in the source material that genuinely shocked me, because it completely upends how we normally think about consequence.
I know exactly what you're going to say.
When the table breaks, well, the individual does not lose their power.
That might be the most terrifying assertion in the entire document.
It challenges our fundamental assumptions about justice. We naturally assume that if a person fails morally, if they prove they are a bad actor, the creator just takes the remote control away. He unplugs the power source. We assume the gift vanishes.
But the text argues the exact opposite.
Right. It says, no, the power isn't lost. It is thoroughly corrupted.
This touches on a deeply held theological and psychological concept, the irrevocability of certain gifts.
Irrevocable, meaning they can't be taken back.
Exactly. Spiritual gifts, innate talents, raw charisma once bestowed, they are often permanent fixtures of a person's capacity. The golden vocal cords of a generational singer do not physically snap just because the singer becomes a raging narcissist.
Right, they can still sing beautifully.
The brilliant strategic mind of a visionary leader doesn't suddenly forget how to organize masses of people just because that leader is secretly embezzling funds. The raw capacity remains intact.
But the table is gone.
Exactly. Because the structural foundation of their character has completely shattered, all of that massive, heavy treasure crashes violently down into the mud. It is now fully compromised by the defiled ground.
And a broken, heavily gifted person becomes exceptionally dangerous. The text explicitly warns that they become an active threat to the people around them. Because now you aren't just dealing with a flawed average human being making mistakes. You are dealing with a flawed human being wielding corrupted supernatural capacity.
And the text introduces a terrifying dynamic here. It argues that nature abhors a vacuum and the spiritual realm operates on similar principles.
A vacuum of character.
Yes. The moment this catastrophic collapse happens and the treasure hits the defiled ground, a hijack occurs. The text posits that malevolent forces, the evil one, immediately step in to utilize these corrupted abilities.
So the gifts are weaponized?
Yes. They are weaponized against the very purposes of the craftsman who gave them. The host structure is broken, so a parasite moves in to direct the remaining power.
That is chilling. The text actually lists the specific dark motivations that take over once this hijack occurs. It details exactly how these shattered tables begin to use their remaining corrupted spiritual gifts.
What's the first one it mentions?
The first motivation is manipulating or exploiting people to amass personal riches. They use their immense charisma, their deep psychological insight, or their lingering authority not to serve the people, but to extract from them. They fleece the very followers they were initially called to protect.
And the tragic psychology of the followers is crucial to understand here. Why do people stay loyal to leaders who have clearly collapsed?
It's baffling from the outside.
It is, but the text suggests that the people being exploited can often still feel the residual heat and brilliance of the original treasure.
Oh, wow. They remember the glow.
Exactly. They remember the genuine power or the pure anointing that was once placed on this leader's table. They confuse that lingering, irrevocable capacity with present, intact character. They follow the glowing, muddy treasure right into the dirt, allowing themselves to be exploited because they mistake power for integrity.
That is a staggering insight into the mechanics of abusive systems. People are staring at the corrupted gold and willfully ignoring the shattered, rotting wood underneath it.
It happens all the time.
The second dark motivation the text identifies is actively tearing down legitimate ministries or healthy organizations out of sheer jealousy and malice.
You have to look at the internal state of a collapsed leader to understand this. When a person's character shatters, their internal world becomes a void of deep insecurity.
Because they know they're hollow.
Exactly. They intuitively know they can no longer generate genuine, pure spiritual fruit because their connection to the roots of humility and sacrificial love has been completely severed.
Yeah.
So how does a broken leader maintain their feeling of superiority? How do they protect their status?
By taking out the competition.
By destroying anyone who is genuinely doing the work of building a strong table. The corrupted gift of insight or communication is suddenly used to hypercriticize, slander, and dismantle the healthy structures around them. It is pure, venomous sabotage masquerading as righteous judgment or necessary critique.
They can't build anymore, so they use their power to demolish. And the final motivation listed by the text is the ultimate end state of corrupted power manufacturing personal fame, pride, and self-idolatry.
The black hole phase.
Exactly. The entire machinery of their immense gifts is turned completely inward. The leader becomes a black hole. Everything they do, every speech, every initiative is secretly about building their personal brand, aggressively protecting their image, and demanding a level of loyalty and worship that belongs only to the creator.
They set themselves up as a counterfeit god.
Yes, using the craftsman's own original currency, the treasure, to fund their rebellion.
It is the ultimate tragedy of potential. The craftsman designed the room, the table, and the treasure for the purpose of outward fellowship and service, but the leader turns it into a fortified bunker of self-worship simply because they refuse to do the hard work of strengthening the wood of their own character.
The weight of this framework is immense. It forces you to rethink every dynamic of power you've ever witnessed. But the source material doesn't just present this as a theoretical, abstract allegory.
No, it grounds it.
It takes this framework and roots it directly into history. It argues that this specific sequence, the heavy gift, the weak character, the ignored splinter, the catastrophic collapse, and the weaponization of the corrupted gift, is a documented repeating pattern across both human and cosmic history.
Yes, the text shifts from allegory to historical analysis, providing two primary case studies to prove its point. One is a human historical figure, and the other operates on a massive celestial scale.
Both scales.
But both case studies operate on the exact same internal physics of power and character.
Let's start with case study one, the human example, King Saul. For those who might only know the broad strokes from historical texts, Saul was the first king of Israel. And according to the source material, Saul received a massive, unprecedented amount of treasure. He received a genuine, undeniable divine anointing to be king.
The craftsman chose him.
Right.
He was the prototype. The historical accounts describe him as head and shoulders above everyone else, both physically and in his initial capacity. He had the right look, he had the initial blessing, and he was given the supernatural enablement required to lead and unify a fractured nation.
So the treasure was real.
The treasure was real, it was pure, and it was extraordinarily heavy. The sheer weight of responsibility for an entire nation was placed squarely on his table.
But the text diagnoses his table as tragically, fatally weak. It lists his specific structural flaws, the exact places where the wood was porous. It says he was plagued by the fear of man, by deep-seated pride, and by erratic impatience.
Let's look at how those specific flaws caused the structural failure. The fear of man meaning he cared more about the approval of the crowds and his soldiers than he cared about the commands of the God who appointed him.
Which is a terrible trait for a leader.
In structural terms, that is a massive rotting fracture in the leg of honesty and integrity. He constantly compromised his principles to keep the applause. Then there was his impatience.
The sacrifice, right?
Yes. There is a famous historical account where the prophet Samuel was delayed in arriving to offer a crucial sacrifice before a battle. Saul, panicking as his army began to scatter, unlawfully took on the role of the priest and offered the sacrifice himself.
He couldn't wait.
That moment is the sound of the crossbeam of patience and humility splintering loudly. He simply couldn't bear the psychological weight of waiting. His ego demanded action.
And crucially, he ignored the splinters. When confronted about his failures, he never deeply repented. He made excuses. He blamed the people. He rationalized his disobedience.
He didn't pull over.
He refused to pull over when the check engine light was flashing. And so the text points out, his table suffered a total, irreversible collapse.
And here is where the corrupted power principle becomes terrifyingly clear. When Saul's character collapsed, did he lose his throne the next day?
No, he ruled for years.
Did his armies vanish? No. The power remained in his hands, but it was now thoroughly corrupted by the defiled ground of his paranoia and pride. The text notes that he spent the rest of his reign weaponizing his royal authority entirely against the will of God.
He spent his final years obsessively hunting down a young man named David. David, who was actually carrying the pure treasure and the true calling at that point. Saul used the entire military apparatus of Israel, resources, gifts, and power that were originally given to him to protect the nation from outside threats, to pursue a personal paranoid vendetta.
He was destroying his own people.
He actively destroyed the peace of his own kingdom.
He grew so corrupted that he murdered a city of innocent priests just because they had unknowingly helped David. He ended his life consulting a medium in the dark, desperate for any shred of supernatural insight because the pure power had long since departed.
It's such a tragic end.
He did far more catastrophic damage to God's purposes in his brokenness than he ever did good in his early years. Saul is presented as the ultimate human example, a deeply broken table wielding hijacked, corrupted power to devastating effect.
But then the text scales up, and the implications of this final section are staggering. The text argues that this principle isn't just human psychology. It is the very origin story of the demonic realm itself. Case study 2, the fallen angels.
The text connects the human struggle for character to a massive cosmic picture. It explains that the entities that rebelled against the creator Lucifer and a third of the celestial host were not created as the grotesque monsters we picture in modern media.
Right, they weren't always demons.
According to the theological framework, they were originally created as beings of immense beauty, staggering authority, and vast supernatural capacity.
They were loaded with divine treasure. They were given a level of power, intellect, and influence that we literally cannot comprehend. The weight of glory placed upon them was astronomical.
Yet, despite their immense power, their table failed. And the text specifies exactly which structural leg gave out their humility and their willing submission to the Creator.
The bank vault malady on a cosmic scale.
Exactly. They looked at the massive, glowing treasure resting upon their own structure, and they became enamored with the gift rather than the giver. They suffered the ultimate cosmic version of the bank vault malady. They obsessed over the wealth of their own beauty and power, and they decided they no longer needed to submit to the craftsman who built them.
The strain of raw pride broke the table. The ancient declaration, "I will ascend, I will make myself like the Most High." The text frames that not just as a statement of rebellion, but as the literal sound of celestial wood violently shattering under the weight of ego.
And the aftermath perfectly aligns with the physics of the allegory. When their character collapsed, did they cease to exist? Did they lose their angelic capacity, their terrifying intelligence, or their supernatural nature?
No.
No. The power wasn't lost. It was entirely corrupted. Their massive celestial gifts fell to the defiled ground of absolute rebellion.
They became demonic. The text says their corrupted, irrevocable gifts are now permanently wielded in a losing war against God. The text is essentially arguing that the entire architecture of evil in the universe is fundamentally just shattered tables, beings that possessed massive power but couldn't handle the weight of the treasure they were given because they rejected humility.
It is the ultimate tragedy of existence, and it powerfully reinforces the core thesis. Humility is not just a polite social convention or a nice moral trait. It is the fundamental structural binding force of the universe.
Without it, things literally fall apart.
Without the reinforcement of humility and character, power always inevitably becomes demonic, whether in the hands of an angel, a king, a CEO, or a spiritual leader.
We have covered so much ground here today. We have walked through the craftsman's room. We have examined the crushing physics of the treasure. We've looked at the distracted bank teller. We've heard the terrifying sound of wood splintering, and we've watched the devastating, far-reaching consequences of a total collapse. From a paranoid king hunting his replacement in the desert to celestial beings falling from the sky, it is a profoundly heavy, urgent reality.
The warning is undeniable and absolute. Gifts without character lead to devastation, and that devastation is never isolated.
It always has a blast radius.
Exactly. It doesn't just destroy the individual whose table breaks. It crushes everyone standing in the room with them. Yeah. It crushes the loyal followers, the innocent bystanders, and the very kingdom or organization they were supposed to serve.
It changes everything about how we should view leadership. It changes how we should evaluate the people we follow, how we should view our own personal ambitions, and what we should be prioritizing in our lives. And it brings us to the core mandated takeaway of this entire document. This is the phrase the text demands we remember word for word. Listen to this with solemn clarity. God has all the treasure he needs in heaven. He is looking for tables strong enough to hold it.
That is the ultimate metric by which all human ambition must be measured. And as we conclude, I want to expand that thought beyond just the individual, because this allegory doesn't just apply to a single person's character. It applies to the institutions, the corporations, and the societies we build.
Oh, absolutely. The collective table.
We live in a culture that is obsessed with scaling up. We want massive technological power, AI, global influence, unbounded economic growth. We are constantly begging the universe for heavier and heavier treasure. But we have to ask ourselves, are the societal tables we are building strong enough to hold the weight of the technology and power we are asking for?
That is a terrifying question.
If our collective character, our cultural honesty, our institutional humility, our shared sacrificial love is rotting, then the immense power we are so desperate to acquire won't elevate us. It will just shatter our collective table, fall into the mud of our worst human impulses, and become weaponized against us. The question isn't whether we can attain more power. The question is whether we are willing to do the unglamorous, agonizing work of building a structure that can survive it.